Hello there, everybody, and welcome to Psyched to Be With You, episode 10. Today, my very special guest is Dr. Catherine Talbot. We speak all things dementia research, older people and technologies, including social media, Pokemon, open world games, and much, much more. I do, however, want to point out that there is a very important content warning for this episode. We do talk about disordered eating. It starts around the 22-minute mark, lasts for about 10 minutes. You will hear this noise, which is a series of abrasive goose honks. I will play them for you now. You will hear those just before and just after the subject is broached. I would also like to say that if you would like any resources, they are attached below. Do please check out Beat. But otherwise, please enjoy the episode as best you can. Thank you very much for listening. Hello everybody and welcome back to episode 10. That's right, we're in double figures now of Psyched to Be With You. Today I've got with me another very special guest. This is the final episode in the season, so we're going to be taking a short break after this to recover from the rapidity and excellence of all the conversations that I've had during this series. But do please join me for this very exciting episode. I will now pass over to my very special guest. Please, could you introduce yourself and tell us what you do?
Yeah, hi everyone. So I'm Dr. Catherine Talbot. I'm a lecturer in psychology at Bournemouth University. I do research in the field of cyber psychology, mainly with people with dementia and older adults, actually. So looking at how they use social media, the benefits, the challenges, all that sort of thing. I also do work with people with eating disorders as well. I sit on the BPS Cyber Psychology Committee, and I'm also the early career rep for the BPS Research Board. So yeah, that's me.
Excellent. So there's lots of sort of stuff we can get into there. Let's usually like to start with work and then sort of out of work. Would you like to just tell us a bit more about what you've been up to recently with your work stuff?
Yeah, of course. So I actually finished my PhD just over a year ago. So mainly with, thank you. It was a great time to finish. but I've mainly been interviewing people with dementia just lately about the impact that COVID-19 has had on their lives. So I've done this both thinking about the impact of lockdown restrictions and the impact it's had on their cognitive abilities, the impact it's had on their confidence, you know, their feelings of anxiety as well. And how that's impacted how they think they can exist in the world after these lockdown measures. So many of the people that I've spoken to just really don't feel confident enough to come out into this new world and to get a bus and, you know, to go see their friends. So actually their social worlds become quite small. And then other than that, I'm also looking at the role of digital technologies for people with dementia as well and how they can potentially expand their social world once again. So looking at things such as Zoom, for example, that, you know, we're all fed up of using, I'm sure, by now. But looking at how people with dementia are using that to connect with others with the diagnosis as well, how they're supporting each other. And also the challenges that are associated with that too.
I mean, it's a fascinating area. I mean, you know, we've spoken a lot, I think even on this show before, about, you know, lockdown and the challenges faced there and how a lot of people turn to like social online gaming. You mentioned everyone's sort of sick of Zoom parties, right? You know, can you tell us a little bit more first of all about like sort of, you know, for listeners' benefit, about dementia and then sort of like how, you know, we can maybe, it's maybe easy for people to understand how the restrictions have impacted people from that group, but maybe a bit more about the impact and the role of digital technologies.
Yeah, of course. So for those listeners that don't know, dementia is actually an umbrella term for a range of symptoms that impact cognitive ability and functional ability as well. And there's actually loads of different types of dementia. So Alzheimer's disease is a type of dementia. Vascular dementia is a type of dementia. And there's approximately around 100 different types of dementia, all with different symptom profiles as well. So it can actually affect people in very different ways. And one common misconception is that it's all about memory. actually some of the people that I've spoken to, their memory is completely intact. Instead, they have problems with balance, or they might have problems with concentration instead, with speech. It depends which area of the brain is impacted. But then if we think about the pandemic, we know that cognitive stimulation is incredibly important for people with dementia, in terms of keeping those memory processes, and also in terms of rehearsing everyday activities as well, that that's incredibly important. But during lockdown, actually, a lot of stimulating activities were suddenly stopped overnight. And a lot of people were suddenly just in their homes, and they didn't have that stimulation that they were normally getting. And this even comes down to simple things like the conversations they were having. The conversations, they said, had suddenly become quite boring. You know, what are we having for dinner? It wasn't stimulating conversations every day. And the people I spoke to were very much of the opinion that if you don't use it, you lose it. So they were starting to notice these changes. And it's also worth saying as well that my research very much focuses on people with early stage dementia. So when we think of a person with dementia, very often because of stereotypes and because of the stigma associated with it, we think of people in the later stages who are typically older people as well. But that isn't the case. There's an early stage, there's a middle stage, and there's a later stage as well. And also because of the nature of my research, the people I speak to are typically younger as well. So that's under the age of 65 is young onset dementia. So then if we think about digital technologies as well, we know that younger people are typically more engaged with digital technologies, or there's more uptake there anyway. So it would then make sense that this group of people with dementia who are in the earlier stages and are younger would be interested in using digital technologies, or at least use them to some degree. So this is where the digital technologies are really important, especially during lockdown, because it could facilitate social connections and facilitate these conversations with other people, gives them access to peer support, because very often when they were in their own homes, they felt like they couldn't speak about their experiences of dementia because they didn't want to upset family members, or family members weren't understanding. Whereas if they got on a Zoom call with their peers, they felt able to express themselves and have a laugh and have a joke about dementia, which they couldn't, they've just felt like they couldn't do with their family, or they didn't understand. And then there's also the activities to keep them stimulated as well, such as gaming. So some of them were playing games as well, you know, just doing various activities on iPads. And they found that that really helped, and that there was this feeling that it kept the dementia at bay during this very difficult time.
It's funny. I've got a couple of little follow-ups there, but one of the things that you know that we're interested, I can almost imagine people's faces listening to that. You say that, you know, people are almost making fun of dementia, and I think that touches on a lot of like this, you know, what we might call sort of in-group out-group things. You know, like when you're experiencing something, and you're all in the same boat. It's kind of, you know, I sort of understand this from being a member of the disabled community, you know, and the visually impaired community. Like, you know, you can kind of make a joke about it, and because you all understand it, it's not a joke is aimed at anyone, like, particularly, right? Have you found that, like, you know, people in this group do use humour a lot? Like, that's a great way to discuss what's happening?
Yeah, 100%. They always talk about having laughs and jokes about it, and that seems to be a really important coping mechanism, actually. And there's a lot of dementia groups around the UK as well, which are peer support groups. And the people I've spoke to about these groups say that they go and they sit, they'll have a pint, and they'll just make these jokes about dementia. And it's like you're saying about being within that group, it's knowing that people understand and they know where you're coming from. Whereas if those jokes perhaps were made by someone who isn't a member of that group, who doesn't understand dementia and perhaps isn't educated, and that there's a big difference there, isn't there? Mm-hmm. And actually, I do find that humour is a very important coping mechanism.
Yeah. You also noted like stigmatisation with sort of relating to the topic. Have you found like, has that been a barrier to speaking to people about this, maybe like some resistance to maybe like accepting what's happening, or like your stigmatization with like people around them?
Mm-hmm. So I talk about this a lot, actually. So the stigma impacts so many different areas of people with dementia's lives. So up to actually achieving that diagnosis, because of the stigma associated with it, many people, they don't want to go to the doctors to talk about this, because if they've got that diagnosis, then they may have to retire from work. They may not be able to drive anymore. People might start seeing them differently as well. So it impacts them in that way. And then there's also the stigma from other people as well. So a lot of people I've spoken to, and it's well reported in the literature as well, that people then interpret their behaviour solely in terms of this label of dementia. So if they've forgotten the keys to the car or something, that's not just interpreted as them, oh, they've just forgot their keys. It's, oh, it's the dementia. It's suddenly everything is about that. And they're no longer necessarily seen as a father, as a husband, as a friend, as someone that has all these other different social identities. It's all interpreted within that label. And then also they can view themselves differently as well. So because of, again, all this stigma and the stereotypes, there's high levels of social isolation, depression, loneliness, anxiety as well within this population too. But, you know, things are starting to change as well. It's worth saying that we are seeing these movements within the dementia community. We're seeing campaigns about kind of living with dementia, really challenging these stereotypes and educating people about what it is to live with dementia. And that's something that my research touches on as well, with social media and the role that that can play in really boosting the narratives and the stories of people with dementia, giving them a platform and showing that they're able to live with the diagnosis.
I mean, you know, you touched on a really interesting point there about, you know, how many times have you committed like a spoonerism, or you've just forgotten something, or you've, like, you know, you walk into a room, you go turn the light on and it's already on. You know, like these little lapses in concentration happen, right? Our brains are so busy. I can think of many, many instances where I've done that type of thing. You know, so I think, yeah, it's really interesting that then that almost then gets transposed onto, like, the condition becomes the identity, not a person with that condition.
Yeah, wasn't it that key psychological study, Rose, that Rosenhan, the stickiness of social labels, where it just, everything is interpreted within that. And, you know, I forget things all the time. I am constantly forgetting things because my brain is so busy. But that can actually be quite damaging for people with dementia if we interpret it in that way, because it limits the social roles that are available to them and the social roles that can be quite helpful. And they might also withdraw themselves from social activities, which they once found to be meaningful. And this can be really problematic because we know that social activities and social relationships are a really big source of identity, which can help promote well-being and having a good quality of life. So yeah, we need to challenge this stigma, definitely.
It's something I always like to, if you pardon the pun, go into all that, as my interviews as blind as possible. You know, I try not to, like, anticipate what people will say, and many of the guests I've had on the show, they're not people I know personally. But when you talk about older adults and digital technologies, one of the first things that leaps to my mind is that kind of, like, well, brain age training. You know, Dr. Kawashima's brain training will solve all the problems. What are your thoughts on, like, that type of technology, but also that type of marketing? Because the other side of that coin is that you hear of A, B, C, D, you know, all linked to dementia, and it's just like, you know, eating an apple or something ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, gosh, yeah, you going back to that brain training just takes me back to when I used to play on the Nintendo DS, I think it was then, and doing all of that. But I guess it's this underlying assumption that getting older is associated with deficits, right? And that we must do everything to keep this at bay, when actually that, you know, that isn't the case for everyone. And also in terms of dementia, there's so much hype in the newspapers. You will find one thing from a study that's perhaps not even a great study and really run with it, like eat steak to stop dementia and all of this. And actually that can be really damaging as well, especially for the people who are currently living with it. No, what we need is evidence. We don't need the hype around this. And it's the same with all the medication as well. Sorry, I'm going off on a tangent. We keep seeing in the newspapers as well, you know, these advancements in drug trials for dementia, and it's always then promoted in the newspaper as, oh, this is going to be the cure for dementia, and it never is. And actually it gives people a false sense of hope. And what we need to also focus on is helping people to live with the condition and to make societies that are inclusive of people with dementia. But yeah, going back to the brain training and the digital technologies, I don't think there's that much evidence for the brain training stuff. I can imagine potentially if people with dementia were to use them, then it might help in situations such as lockdown, for example, when we're very isolated and there's limited cognitive stimulation. That they might be helpful, but equally they can do other activities on digital technologies that are stimulating. You know, playing video games is stimulating as well. It doesn't have to be, oh, let's do this one test where, you know, count how many things are here. You can find other things that are also enjoyable too.
Was that age old kind of, I'm going to say meme, but like chess is the intellectual cure for everything.
Yeah.
Play chess every day and your brain will be hardwired for eons. Like,
yeah, exactly. And me and a friend were talking about something similar, mainly around reading books, actually. And we were saying that there's such a snobbery around it, that is for higher level, you know, cognition and higher level intellectual people. But if you're playing video games, then, you know, that's not the same kind of stimulation, and you're not working your brain in the same way. And it's really annoying, actually.
You make an interesting point. I mean, I feel like there's so many like subdivisions of that argument that like reading on a e-reader is not the same as reading a book. You know, all these, like, you know, video games are not the same. And like, you know, I mean, obviously I'm biased. I play games, I study games, but like, you have to account for so much when you're playing a game, particularly if it's like one that involves action or strategy. Like, you have to think, like, to use a chess metaphor, like a couple of moves ahead to stay in the game. It's a very active, whereas reading is much more in that sense passive. You're just reading the narrative, words, you move the page.
And people read to go to sleep, right? I think people should just be allowed to do what they enjoy. And stimulation can come in many different forms.
Well, as we all know, the most stimulating medium is podcasts.
Yeah, exactly. And especially this one.
Exactly. So you heard it here first. I can get that on the promo for season two.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think we've got a really sort of clear idea. So you say you're sort of looking at the impact of this now. Have you got any sort of, I don't want to say results, but you know, any sort of, like, what have you found that maybe you can tell us about from this sort of discussion?
Yeah, of course. So I'll probably talk about my Twitter research, actually, which has focused on how people with dementia are using social media, because that's out there, whereas my digital technologies paper was still waiting on the reviews.
You've got to keep that, keep that under wraps a little bit longer, I'm afraid.
Yeah, although there is a preprint version. But in terms of Twitter, which is what my PhD was in, we found that it was an incredible resource for people with early stage and young onset dementia. So there's this theory called the shrinking world theory, that following a diagnosis of dementia, the world of a person with dementia starts to shrink. And that's because, you know, a loss of confidence, loss of independence, just it shrinks. But by using Twitter, what they were able to do was able to connect with their peers who perhaps, you know, they didn't have access to in their offline environments or didn't feel comfortable going to a dementia group. And they were able to connect with people who were kind of a similar age to them as well. And this was really important because they could see that these people were living with dementia. They were tweeting about their lives and doing everyday activities. And actually this gave them a lot of hope, because after receiving the diagnosis, the post-diagnostic support was rubbish. A lot of them said, you know, it's just this black hole. I was very depressed at the time. Some of the doctors actually just told them, oh, you know, you've got dementia, off you go. And that was it. Yeah, I know, awful, awful.
Yikes.
But by going onto Twitter, this was actually quite an important source of post-diagnostic support, just in terms of connecting with their peers. But also it was really good as it gave them a sense of identity. It allowed them to work out what it actually means to be a person with dementia, especially at this time when they'd lost so many other aspects of their identity, such as their working identity, you know, that some other social identities as well. They were able to get this kind of more of a community sense of identity. And many of them went on to get involved in advocacy work as well, which became their new working identity following that. And we also found that Twitter was a really good way for some of them to communicate. And this was because it was limited, it had the character limit. So they were able to focus on what they were trying to say without getting confused with too much on there, like they did with Facebook, for example. So that was really useful and really nice to see as well. However, it is worth pointing out that it wasn't all positive. You know, there are trolls and not very nice people on Twitter as well, especially if they're publicly identifying as a person with dementia. Some people aren't always that nice online. And then there's also people on Twitter who doubt their diagnosis as well, who I've called dementia doubters. And
TM.
These are some, thank you. These are carers of people in the later stages of dementia, or people who've typically worked with people with more late stage dementia who don't, perhaps aren't exposed to those in the earlier stages of the disease, and, you know, don't think that a person with dementia could use Twitter, for example, or could do all of these things. So then these people publicly doubt their diagnosis. And then this has an impact on the person, you know. They feel like they've suddenly made sense of this identity. Then they go online and people are casting doubt on it, calling them a fraud and all of this sort of stuff. So there are positives and negatives.
For more on trolling, check out episode 1 of the podcast with Dr. Chrissy Cook, communications researcher. Sorry, I'm obliged to plug things like that. no, you make an interesting point, because I was kind of, I could feel, again, the raised eyebrows when you're like, well, Twitter was actually quite good. Because, again, yeah. Social media, you know, let's not crack open a bigger debate, but just social media generally is viewed very negatively. In my personal experience, one of the things I prefer Twitter, say, to other social media is that I can completely curate what I see. And that for me is a big thing. Like, I always say to people, like, don't take it personal if I don't follow you or if I don't follow you. It's just that's me. I want to really curate what I see and don't. I mean, you know, I feel like we've all done it. We've all sort of clicked on a juicy trending thread, and then we've seen people having arguments in the things, and they're like, wow, I've just spent 20 minutes of my life doing nothing. But, you know, so that's a really interesting sort of thing. Then it's nice that, you know, that. In a strange way, even something like the character limit really was actually quite a positive element for people from that group. Have you got any sort of other pieces of your work you'd like to give mention to? You mentioned you do sort of look at sort of eating disorders as well in the intro.
Yeah, so the eating disorder stuff. So my dementia stuff is, I would say, more on the kind of positive side of social media. Whereas my eating disorder stuff, it tends to fall on the more negative side, I guess, really. So I got interested in this when I was doing my undergraduate dissertation, actually. So it was looking at eating disorder communities online, and I should probably give a trigger warning for this, actually.
There will be ones that, like, at the very top of the audio as well. Okay. But yeah, thank you for putting that in for us. Okay.
No, of course, of course. So looking at communities online that potentially encourage disordered eating behaviours and the negatives of that is something that I'm really, really interested in, and kind of how we can either steer people away from those communities or build resilience, and how we can think about that within a therapeutic setting as well, and the role that social media may play within that.
Mm-hmm. Can you sort of, like, I know it's quite, again, quite a broad term, but can you maybe just break down a little bit for listeners' benefit of what disordered eating is? Because I think, again, it's a term that's loaded with stigmatization and myth, almost.
Yeah, definitely. And this is something I've been working on with a colleague at Northumbria University, Dr. Dawn Franley Bell, and we're kind of challenging some of the misunderstandings and misconceptions around eating disorders. Because when you think of eating disorders, you typically think of anorexia nervosa, right? And, you know, that's not the only eating disorder. There's actually lots of different types of ones as well. There's binge eating disorder. Yeah, there's lots more. And you also typically think of women as well, when actually men are affected by disordered eating as well. And there's lots of amazing advocates on Twitter who are doing amazing work and promoting all of this. And this is something actually that we've looked at during the pandemic that me and Dawn have investigated as well. It's done a lot of COVID research just lately, actually.
Very prominent.
Yeah, and we found that disordered eating has potentially become worse during the lockdown periods. So people, they spoke about restricting their food intake a lot more. They spoke about this kind of feelings of shame and feeling bad for eating when there was food scarcity. You know, people were in the supermarkets treading over each other to get food. There was, in some places, it was really hard to get food. So some of the people that we surveyed, they felt this sense of shame by having that. Or then there was also some things around exercise as well. So some people reported having more time to exercise because they didn't have to go into work. So they would over-exercise with the kind of desire to lose weight. But then there were also some people who weren't exercising as much as they did before lockdown. And again, this promoted these feelings of shame and this sense of guilt, and they felt like they'd gained weight. So as a result, they restricted their food intake. And then on top of that, we had the government campaigns as well, which all focused on let's lose weight, let's fat shame everyone, which is
coupled with eat out to help out.
Yeah, and then also saying let's put calories on menus, you know, which is really damaging for people with eating disorders. But if anyone listening to this is struggling, then I definitely recommend looking at BEAT, the UK's leading charity for eating disorders. There's lots of helpful resources on there.
Links will be provided wherever you found this in the show notes.
Awesome.
But yeah, we could talk about politics, but let's not. But I think, yeah, just there are so many just wild kind of decisions that were made. That it, just looking at like those sort of three things, like, you know, even the so, you know, calories on menus, so many people are like, oh, well, you know, okay, that's great. You know, like, I know what. And it's like, you know, as you pointed out, that you should, like anything, you should be given the option to have it or not. You know, there's a big debate in, like, ethical game design. You should be given the opportunity to know what you're going to be presented with before you're presented with it. And then, at any opportunity, opt out and sort of, you know, skip anything that, you know, that you don't want to observe. And I feel like it's the same sort of thing. You should be able to, you know, with or without calorie, you know, caloric, you know, measurement. Very simple thing. You know, we have just about got to a point where you can have menus for people with different allergies or different dietary requirements. Not, are we asking too much, you know?
I think that's an excellent idea, and I love you saying that about gaming design. I think that's brilliant. I would love that. Going off on a tangent, something else that I've been interested in just lately is orthorexia, which isn't official diagnosis yet, and it's something we're exploring, which is an unhealthy obsession with clean or raw eating. So, you know, eating stuff that hasn't been processed, low sugar, low fat. It's kind of an unhealthy obsession with what we would term healthy. So we're investigating that at the moment, which is really interesting. And it's really interesting as well if we think of it in terms of social media and, you know, all the fitness cultures that seem to have come to light, and this focus on this fit and healthy body. That it perhaps, if we think mainly in terms of women, I'm thinking now that it's not enough now for women to just be skinny. Women have to be skinny and they have to be toned and fit.
Well, you know, I recall this, I've had this in a few conversations. I, you know, I was a younger person, during the sort of, you know, noughties and through the sort of 2010s. And I remember this, you know, the size zero boom. You know, I remember, yeah. And I always remember, and I frame it in the context of a joke as a means to help people understand that maybe aren't interested or don't care. But like, I remember, you know, there were literal ads on TV that were like, does my bum look big in this? And that was like the biggest insult you could give to often people who identified as women. And like, it was like a huge, it was a huge thing at the time. It was like, oh gosh, this could be the worst physical attribution I could be given. And now we have this polarity of, you know, oh well, women have to be also skinny and toned, but also have large posteriors and other areas. We could get into how a lot of that may relate to cultural appropriation. We'll maybe not go down there. It's a big debate. But it's so strange how even just in a few years, things have just changed so rapidly in the culture.
Yeah, 100%. It's just, yeah, because I remember, because I was a young person as well in the 90s and the noughties, and I remember it also being this focus on, yeah, size zero, very, very skinny, whereas now it is all about that, you know, 0% body fat, abs. It's just totally unachievable for most people as well. I know it's certainly unachievable for myself. So, you know, it's just all these expectations that are put onto people. And I know that we've mainly spoke about women there, but also the pressures on men as well now to, you know, be big, to be muscular, seeing all of this on social media, you know, plan your meals, have this protein, everything. I'm on a study at the moment where we are looking at representations of fitness on social media, and we are actually seeing quite a lot of men there as well, whereas when we did it a few years ago, it was mainly women. So it's quite interesting to see how that's changed.
I really want to just pick up just a real neat statement you said there, is that it doesn't kind of matter what the shift is, it's just that it's almost like it's pre-designed to be unachievable. Like, because I feel like we had this kind of brief period, maybe like sort of like mid-2010s, where a lot of kind of stuff went downhill in the 2010s, personally, you know, geopolitically. But, like, you know, there almost seemed to be this turning point where I felt things where we were being a lot more, body welcome. We were, you know, celebrating everyone's different sizes and shapes, and sort of saying, you know, everyone comes in different shapes and sizes. This is the thing we should celebrate, enjoy that diversity. And then, as you say, it was like, society went, well, we can't have people being happy and comfortable and confident in who they are, which you totally should be, by the way, if you're listening to this. And we're like, okay, well, we're going to have to give them something else that's just entirely unachievable.
Yeah, there's always going to be something, isn't there? And it's just like you say, it's always going to be unachievable unless you're a rich person, essentially, that has all of these trainers, all of this time to dedicate to it. Yeah, exactly. But I will say as well, there has been some body positivity movements in the past few years. And we've seen those as well on social media, which is lovely to see. And I guess within my circle, because it's carefully crafted, I do see a lot of that body positivity and diverse bodies. And it's really wonderful to see. But I wonder, outside of my circle, because I live in a bit of an echo chamber, if how that's actually trickling down and the impact that it's having, especially during lockdown, where we have just seen such a focus on fitness and indoor workouts, Joe Wicks doing his thing every morning. I just wonder whether that's got lost a little bit.
I do also, I think, maybe just, you know, to help sort of segment things a little bit, but I also just want to point out before we finish this sort of segment, is that like the picture of health and weight or physicality are different for everyone. They're not one thing, you know. I mean, I know myself, like, I've been, you know, round the mill on all these sort of things as a young person has done throughout these years. I'm saying young, I'm an old man, but you know what I mean. But like, just being impacted by these things, like, it's just different for anyone. I think, you know, at the end of the day, like, you know yourself, and people are built to be different, right? Like, there's no...
Yeah, exactly. All bodies are different, and yeah, it's just doing what works for you, what makes you feel good, what makes you feel happy as well. And being mentally happy as well. So I know for myself, when I'm doing my fitness and stuff, I don't do it to look a certain way. I do it just as a stress buster and to make myself feel good on the inside. I'm kind of past caring what it means, what it looks like, because everyone's different.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. That's great. I just want to appreciate your sensitivity with that discussion as well, and sort of just being able to bring so much of that knowledge to the show. I appreciate it. Let's sort of talk about when you're not working. What do you like to get up to?
Oh, well, at the moment I'm doing a lot of yoga, actually, but not just any kind of yoga. I'm doing hot yoga. Nice. So it's in 40 degree heat, like really humid as well. And you go through all of these poses and you look like you've had a shower after. Actually, I look awful. But yeah, that's great fun. That's what I do in my spare time and it keeps me relaxed.
I've done some hot yoga. It is sweaty business.
Have you? Yeah. Oh, I love it. It's great.
It's good. I think, like, I have to ask, what kind of like style of yoga do you do or prefer?
It's vinyasa that I do at the moment. But on a Sundays when I go to cool yoga, I do yin yoga because it's a lot more chilled.
Yeah, I personally prefer the yin kind of stuff myself. I think the flow, the vinyasa sort of stuff is like gets very intense in the heat, I found.
Yeah, and I know that with yoga, you're not meant to compare yourself to other people, but I think I am quite a competitive person and a bit of a perfectionist. So seeing all the other people do all these headstands and everything, and I'm there like, what's going on?
it. I'll share this quick anecdote. I was at the front of the class once. Because that's where there was a mat. And you don't want to be in the front of a class in a yoga class. Let me just point that out. And we were doing forward folds. And I just, because of the shape of my body, my legs are longer than the rest of me, I just cannot fold very far. And I was just, and the whole sort of thing with hot yoga is that because you're warm, it's meant to help with your flexibility and your muscle relaxants and stuff. I just couldn't do it. Love no money, and I accepted this, and I was working within myself, which is the whole kind of point. But the instructor, she comes up and she's like, George, do you want me to help you take the stretch a little bit deeper? And I was like, oh, okay. Next thing you know, she's like sandwich making me, and I honestly thought like my hip / groin was about to explode. But like, obviously, but for context though, this is like a 7 p.m. in like a December evening, and there's this chill music on, and like I just almost didn't feel comfortable like expelling any pain at that point. Like I couldn't verbalize that. So I was just there and she's like, oh, you're doing great. Doing great. And I'm there just like, my head's on the floor. Like I'm in two parts at this point. That was fun. And by fun, I mean excruciating.
Yeah. There's times when I'm doing it, when I just think I hate myself. Why have I brought myself here? I could be at home. But then when I leave, I think, no, actually, that was good. And I'm going 4 times a week at the moment, so, which is very hard to do while working in academia, actually, but work-life balance.
Work-life balance. Okay, well, so what else are you doing? You're not being a yogi?
An amateur yogi. I play a lot of video games, actually. I have quite different tastes in video games, so I'd say the best one I've ever played is Red Dead Redemption 2.
Whoa, I right absolutely in there. Love it. Weird.
Yeah,
best game.
Yeah, best game I've ever played, I think, and nothing lives up to it at the moment. But in lockdown, obviously, I played a lot of Animal Crossing, and I'm very, very excited for the next update.
Yeah, so I mean, to timestamp this, where are we with like 20th of October, 2021? The update's due out, I think, early November, is it? Mid November?
Yeah, I think it's the 7th of November or something like that.
It's very soon. Animal Crossing. All right, I will say that I put in like 100 hours into Animal Crossing, like yourself, played a lot through lockdown, got my island exactly the way I wanted it, 5-star island, and I was like, yeah, I'm done, I'll put it down. Even with the other updates, I haven't picked it back up.
Yeah, no, I'm, to be honest, I was quite similar. I got it and I thought, oh my God, I can't stop playing this game. I love it. Got my island. Amazing. It's beautiful. And then I picked it back up with a few of the other updates. So when you could go diving, I love that. Yeah, and then it kind of trickled off, and it trickled off as we started to come out of the first lockdown. So I feel like it served a purpose then. But with the new update, I am very excited, and I think I'm just going to start over again, you know?
Oh, bold.
I know. I'm just going to do it. Just do it.
Bold, fair. I paid DLC. You're going to get in on that?
I don't know if I want it that much.
Well, I was having this debate on stream over the weekend, actually, and saying, like, because they're offering the paid DLC outright for Animal Crossing, but they're also bundling it in with the Nintendo Switch Online expansion. So, like, you can pay for Nintendo Switch Online, which lets you play online, and you access a few features, including NES and SNES games. So I think, currently in the UK, is like $17.99 for the year, right, for a single user. That reportedly, maths about right, is about to double, and for that you'll also get N64 games in the Sega Genesis. So they kind of, I think, have thrown Animal Crossings in the hope that a lot of people will just kind of go, well, I'll get future Animal Crossings updates as well as a bunch of other stuff. Can I like financially justify doubling my online membership for like when I already have too many games, and I'm not sure if I'm going to go back to Animal Crossings, like.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I do think starting a new island is the way to go. And I feel like you should do it as well. I feel like just take the plunge.
Look, Misty Isle is perfect, and I want to leave it the way it is.
Mine is called Talbling Town.
Nice.
Yeah, I know. Beautiful. Nice. Other games I like, Zelda Breath of the Wild is an amazing game, if you've played that.
I've played it. Okay, this is me blabbing now. If you've listened to this before, you've probably heard me say this, but one of the problems I have with games is that they're so massive and expansive, and I tend to just play whatever I'm in the mood for. I've got to, like, feel it if I'm going to play it. And I put the game down, and then every time I pick it up, I go, what the heck am I doing? The world is so vast, and so I've even got the DLC for that, so you can see where you've been for the past 100 hours, and I'm still like, what the heck am I doing? And then I put it down again because I get overwhelmed.
They are big nowadays. They are huge games. And Zelda's massive. Zelda Breath of the Wild. It's just so huge. But again, that helped me during the pandemic. I found gaming during the pandemic to be so helpful. It's kept me sane, made me feel a little bit better, given me something to focus on, particularly with Animal Crossing. When the whole world was ending, I could create my own little world, and it was nice and wonderful, and just get lost in it.
Well, I was going to kind of point out there, the three games you kind of mentioned, they're all big, huge worlds that have their own lives and exist within their own kind of universes. Is there a trend there?
Yeah, there definitely is. I also really, really like Stardew Valley and Littlewood. So, yeah, my partner was actually joking because I have all these games that are like little towns and stuff. And he said, are you sure that you don't actually just want to be a mayor? Is that your calling in life, to be a mayor? And I thought of that, and I thought, yeah, I'm going to be a mayor of a little town somewhere. So, yeah, those are my sort of games where it's quite big, or you can have a simulation or something. I love it.
Fair enough. I've confessed before, I've still not rectified it, but I have not fully played Stardew Valley. Again, like, I've picked it up and then just, like, gone, I appreciate that this is great, but I just get really overwhelmed early on. And then, like, I know you can get to a point where you get upgrades and you have more stamina and stuff, but I've just never got to that point. Just not enough time, you know.
Oh gosh. You're missing out.
I've had I'm gonna say playfully threats to, like, get people will be like, we will play it multiplayer and we will make it happen.
You should do it. We can play if you want.
Yeah, why not? It's a game, like, I know I need to play, you know. It's just meant to be so good. Like,
Skyrim's good as well. That's another big world game that I absolutely love.
Have you got a classic kind of, what's your preferred build on Skyrim?
Oh, okay, so I'm always a mage. I'm a battle mage. Yeah, always, which apparently is quite weird. I've heard most people are sneaky archers.
Sneaky archer is popular, yeah.
Yeah, I just don't see the point of playing it like that. I'm more, let's do offense. Go. But yeah, I love Skyrim as well. Just get absolutely lost in it.
Okay, how many versions of it do you own, and how many saves have you got?
Okay, well, to be honest, I got into it quite late. So it was only about a year and a half, 2 years ago. So it was towards the end of my PhD, which wasn't a good time to get into it because I'd go work at my postdoc all day, come home to work on my finishing my PhD, and just play a lot of Skyrim, actually. So I actually only have three saves at the moment, and it's only because I've still got the game from my friend who lent it to me 2 years ago, and I still need to return it. But there's been a pandemic, so it's fine.
Fair. I mean, I also haven't played Skyrim, but like, yeah, I know.
But you do gaming research.
I call myself a game. I know. Again, it's too big. I've started the save on it, and then it was like, you can now do what you want, and I went, okay, I'll go this direction, and just got flattened and went, well.
It's not for me.
You know what, like, I'm sure I'd love it if I actually got into it, but it's like I really struggle with when there are that many sort of choices and customization options. But I call me a negative perfectionist, but I'm like, I want to be good at everything, and then you just end up being crap at everything because you just don't spend your stat
Yeah.
points well.
Yeah, you need to pick. It's like The Sims, isn't it, really, where you need to focus on one skill to start with.
Okay, so have you sort of got any
Yeah.
other gaming mentions that you've got? Like anything else, like good? Or anything that you're looking forward to, maybe?
Looking forward to the next Pokemon game that's coming out. I know that they're doing a remastered version of, is it Pearl and
Diamond and
one
Pearl, yeah.
Diamond and Pearl, yeah, which comes out next month. And then there's the new Pokemon game which comes out next year. So very
Yes,
excited about that,
Pokemon
which will be good.
Arceus. That looks good.
Yeah. It does. It does. So I'm very excited about that. Can't wait to play those. Yeah, there's loads of good stuff coming out.
Are you a big Pokemon fan?
Yeah, are you?
Oh yeah, huge. I mean, I'm not sure how well you can see it, but like behind me, I've got my collection of Nintendo handhelds up there. So
Oh, yeah.
big Pokemon fan.
Yeah, I got into Pokemon when I was quite young, and I had the sticker book and everything. So first gen is the best, obviously.
Oh, controversial,
Is
controversial. Gen 2, gold and silver, because you get both regions.
I actually, yeah, gold. I think gold is the best because, yeah, you can then play on the other region, can't you? I love that when they brought out Heart Gold and
Soul
Soul
Silver.
Silver.
With the Pokéwalker, which was Pokemon Go, for any of the true believers, the true knowledgeable people.
I met so many random people playing Pokemon Go in the streets. That was wonderful. That was a great time. So simple.
It was such a boom. Like it's yeah, such a great time. When you could just meet people in the street and have a conversation.
Yeah,
That
some
was
random people would just lend me their chargers and everything. It was brilliant.
good times, good days. I've then gotta ask, just because have you got a preferred starter type?
Well, it depends which game we're playing, really.
That's a
But
sensible answer.
my favorite would be fire type, I think.
Nice,
What about
classic.
you?
I always tend to go for grass.
Oh.
Oh.
The
Such disapproval.
Yeah, I am disappointed.
Fair. I mean, like I know, like, speaking Gen 1, Gen 2, like tactically it makes sense to pick the fire one because, there are fewer fire types that are accessible, generally speaking, throughout the game. I know that. But yeah, I've just always liked the grass critters. I don't know why.
Oh, that's cute though.
I
That's
do I do
oh.
I do agree that I think Torchic is probably the best one from Ruby. Like I think just like you can steamroll the whole game with just a Blaziken. With like in
Oh,
most
I
people
just can't wait. I can't wait for the game to come out now. You've got me excited.
I'll admit I've still got Ultra Sun I need to play, and I haven't done the Delta episode of the Omega Ruby remake on the 3DS.
Yeah, I haven't played some of the newer ones. So I played Sword and Shield, but the ones before that, I'd kind of stopped playing around that point. So hopefully they'll do some more remakes or something at some point and I'll play them.
Well, I am very proud to say that on Pokemon Box, which was like the storage software on the DS, and obviously for those that don't know, if you Pokemon Generations, they came out, they actually made a way for you to be able to link them for a very long time. Mm. So you could, I have, through the process of many, many hours spent transferring, I still have the original starter Pokemon that I had on Pokemon Ruby when I was a young boy. Even now, they're sitting on my 3DS, and I will eventually transfer them to Pokemon Home on the Switch.
Oh, that's cool.
I'm just going to flex now to try and redeem some of that disappointment. I 97, like, well, 97% legitimately completed the Pokemon Ruby Pokédex.
That's pretty impressive.
I say 97 because I think it was Cerebi and a couple of, like, and like Mew and ones like that. Someone traded me them. You know, I traded them back so I could get the Pokédex entry. But I have no idea if they were legitimate. Because back in the day, ladies and gents, let me dial this. Back in the day when games were cartridges and you couldn't connect them to the internet, you know, you had to go to special events. You had to go to, like, Toys R Us, and, like, they would have a machine that you plugged your game into, and that would give you an event Pokemon. That was how you used to do it. None of this just downloading from the internet. Malarkey. But I'm very proud.
It was such a different time.
I'm very proud of the fact that I can go on that game. It still just about works. And go to the guy and, like, get the little certificate that says you completed the Pokédex. But I use, Pokemon Colosseum, Gale of Darkness that a friend had, like, Fire Red and Leaf Green, Ruby and Sapphire, like, all of them got it sorted.
Pokemon Colosseum was so good. I remember, was that on the GameCube, I think?
That game.
At the time.
It's on my shelf behind me. It's my nemesis.
Why?
And I'll tell you for why. Because, obviously, that was, like, famously the way to get Ho-Oh, the legendary Pokemon Gold, on Pokemon Ruby and Sapphire, right? But it was not clear how to do that. So I beat the main game, I purified all the Pokemon, I did the 100 battle thing, nothing. Because you had to do it in the separate mode from the main menu as well. And that was not made clear. So the amount of times I thought, the game must be broken, and started a new save. That's why
I feel like you're still upset about this.
I'll never let it go. And that's a reason why I've got, like, an army of the three rare dogs, Espeon and Umbreons and Tyranitars on my Pokemon box, because from just doing multiple playthroughs of that game. Many hours.
That's brilliant.
I think the time that I did it, I actually pulled, like, an all-nighter. I was like, I'm getting this done tonight. It's happening. I, like, finally beat that 100 one and got the time flute for it or whatever. And I was like, finally, and then just fell asleep.
Life goals.
Yeah, so, you know, but, you know, back when, again, like, I was a younger person, I actually had time to do that.
Yeah, I miss those times.
I'm reticent to use the phrase spare time anymore, because none of my time is spare. It is all spent.
Nice.
I just have non-work time, very smidgens of it. And I'm totally classifying this as work, by the way. This is networking and professional information exchange.
Totally professional. Completely professional.
100%. If you can't professionally rant about Pokemon Colosseum, what do you do?
I do think it's important to carve out that time, though, as well, especially working in academia as well, because it can just so quickly take over your life, and you can be working non-stop if you're not careful, because there's no real clear-cut hours. There's just constantly something to be doing, something to be working towards. So it's really important to have that time carved out and just to focus on yourself as well.
How do you find, like, managing that? Because, I mean, you said obviously you're working on research in academia, you're also part of the cyberpsychology BPS section, and you also said you were the early careers rep for another section.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's for the research on the research board for the BPS. Yeah, it's hard actually to get a good work-life balance. I think I've started to get a little bit better with managing it now, because I've kind of realised that if you're working these unhealthy hours, and then you're not only making it harder for yourself, you're actually making it more difficult for your colleagues as well, because you're just pushing that goalpost further and further, and the expectations then are increased. So actually, although most of the issues need to come from the top down, don't get me wrong, there is some responsibility there as well. So for me, what I do is I actually block time off in my calendar. I try to have very strict working hours, although there are some times when, I can't stick to that because of grant deadlines or whatever. And I have a strict rule of not working weekends as well. But obviously, I also realise I'm in quite a privileged position. I don't have any caring responsibilities or anything else that takes up my time too. So, yeah, and also just making sure that I have time to do the things that help me to be kind of the best person. So doing yoga, making time to go to cute coffee shops if I want to, going to the pub with my friends, because I actually work a lot better if I'm a happier person and if I'm making that time for myself as well. And I think when you're so overwhelmed with work in academia, it can be very difficult to take that time away and to take that break, but actually it's really important.
What kind of do you get up to in your committee roles, if you can tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, of course. So actually, my committee role started when I was in SciPag, which I know that you're a member of now, right? I started being I was the communications officer for SciPag, and then I was vice chair for a bit as well, which was great. But now that's kind of led into me being on the BPS Cyber Psychology Committee. So within that, I kind of spread the word about cyber psychology, really promoting it as a discipline. At the moment, I'm on the editorial board for the Cyber Psychology Bulletin. So I help to review some of the papers that we get submitted and see what we can include, and that gets sent out to members. Also involved in things in sort of social events as well, organising those, and really just getting involved where I can in whatever happens with the committee. So whether it's the conference that we have each year, that listeners, if you want to come, you definitely should come because it's going to be great and it's going to be fun. And just seeing how I can help out with stuff like that. With my position on the research board for the BPS, that's really interesting because you get to hear about all these kind of high level decisions and discussions that are going on about psychology in the UK, and my job is to act as kind of the early career voice and to get involved in committees. So there's lots of stuff around diversifying the curriculum at the moment, and there's lots of discussions around open science. I'll be involved in reviewing bursaries for early career people.
Can you define what early career means for listeners?
Oh, that's difficult. Yeah. So I think the general definition of early career researcher is 5 years post PhD, which is quite broad. And, sometimes it'll go up to 8 years because obviously in the nature of the job, a lot of people are on temporary contracts for quite a long time at the moment. So between 5 to 8 years following a PhD, really.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sorry, I interjected there.
No, it's fine. I think I was pretty much done anyway. It's just, being the early career voice and representing those people's voices and their interests. And I think I come from a bit of an interesting position because I'm a qualitative researcher. So that means I speak to people, have chats and use those conversations as data. Whereas often quite a lot of the policies that come from higher up are more for quantitative research, so all about numbers. And actually, I could see it as part of my role to challenge that, especially when we're having discussions around open science and everything. I'm thinking, well, if that's becoming dominant, then what does that mean for qualitative researchers? And what does that mean for qualitative early career researchers? Is our research being sidelined? Is it them being seen as less fundable, as less publishable, and really thinking about the knock-on effects of that sort of thing as well.
Mm-hmm. I also, and this is it's a little bit of a naughty question, so I apologise in advance, but something that came from the cyberpsychology meeting that we had quite recently, because I'm also on that committee, disclosure. Cyberpsychology, like, there's a big challenge in defining what that is. So I'm not going to ask you to define it, but I'm going to say...
I was going to say,
what is cyberpsychology for you personally?
Okay. So for me, cyberpsychology is very broad. And for me, it's the psychology of human-computer interaction, very broadly. So specifically thinking about technologies such as social media, virtual reality, gaming, and the psychological, I guess, impacts of those on individuals, on society. That is my broad approach to it. And I think we can use a range of methods within that as well to study it.
That's fair enough. But yeah, call me a young gun, but I personally think, like, mixed methods is the way to go. Like, what if you're going to get people to fill out some surveys, like, give them a couple open-ended questions. You know, tease out what they think a little. You know what I mean? Like, why and when it can be or, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's just using what's appropriate for your research question. And again, I know I was talking about a bit of snobbery earlier. There is typically this snobbery where people look down on qualitative research and it not being scientific and all of that sort of stuff. But that just needs to be gone. That does not have a place in psychology, I don't think. We're all doing really interesting, really cool, really awesome stuff that's hopefully rigorous, and it all has a place.
Okay, so
sorry, I went on a rant.
Rants are also encouraged. They make for great listening. Next couple of questions are sort of looking towards the future. So what do you sort of see as, like, what's next for your work? Like, be that sort of like the next sort of physical paper, or sort of maybe more aspirationally, what do you think is sort of next for you?
Yeah, so I want to start to get some funding. Because that's kind of what's really missing, I think, from my profile as an early career researcher. I'm starting to develop this publication record, which is really, really nice. I would now like to get some funding to continue my dementia work with on digital technologies as well, specifically. So that's what I'm going to be looking for. I'm going to be looking to set up a program of research around that. And yeah, hopefully get some money in so I can pay my lovely participants and really start to do some cool things with social media, with assistive technologies as well, and really championing the voices of people with dementia as well. So making sure that their voices are included in the design of digital technologies, because it's really important that what we're designing for them actually meets their needs. So that's my aim. It would be really nice if someone would give me funding.
Fair. So if you're listening, you want to fund some dementia research, you know where to go.
Yeah, I'll set up a GoFundMe.
Yeah. One of my favourite questions I always ask is, if you had no limitations, what would you look at doing? Like, this can be like a business, an entrepreneurial adventure. It can be a research thing. I always frame the context of mine as that I would look at a longitudinal study of people playing the video game Celeste. It's one of, it's for me, the best game ever made. It talks about mental health themes. It's incredibly enjoyable. The entire soundtrack is just banger after banger. And, like, you know, but it's like a, if you do everything, like a 70-hour experience. Like, not for just the main game, but, you know, like, that's a lot. And, like, really capture all that beautiful data of people's experiences. What would you do? Limited resources, access to participants, and research assistants. What would you do?
Yeah, okay. That's a very good question. So what I would do is I would do an ethnographic study where I would go into care homes and I would look at getting digital technologies into care homes and observing how they're used, what the benefits are, what opportunities there could be, and how we can also adapt these technologies as well for people with perhaps middle to late stage dementia as well. that's what I do. I think that'd be really cool.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but ethnography is kind of very like community based. It's sort of like looking at a group of people and sort of really engaging with that community and sort of understanding what it's like to be part of it. Is that right?
Yeah, essentially, but it's also quite observational and submerging yourself actively into those communities. So I would kind of sit there and do a lot of snooping, essentially, and observing all of these interactions, seeing how the care staff would handle doing these digital technologies, and then you do interviews with them as well to supplement that. I would love to do something like that. I think it would be brilliant, just to see how useful they can be and how useful they can be in practice as well, because very often we find that a lot of technologies that are developed for people with dementia, there's loads of them out there, but actually the uptake is limited. So it's showing that there's a bit of a disconnect there, and what are the reasons for that? I'd love to see that within a care home context.
Okay. And sort of one of my final questions for you before we get into the fun quick fire round is, is there anyone or anything that like inspires you? It can be professionally or personally that you'd like to give mention to. I always say you can be inspired by many things and many people, but I always like to just give you know, the floor to just give note to anyone in particular.
Yeah, so I've been fortunate to have been supervised by some fantastic women in academia and to have had both formal and informal mentorship. So I'd say there are a couple of women who really inspire me. I'll just give a shout out to a few of them. So Dr. Linda Kay, for example, I think she's so inspiring, and being
Big
the
legend.
Chair of the cyber Yeah, absolute legend. Being the chair of the cyber psychology section, does amazing, rigorous research. So I find her so inspirational and can only dream of kind of being like her one day. My PhD supervisor as well, Dr. Siobhan O'Dwyer, is such a massive source of inspiration because she does this amazing research with carers about suicidality and homicide as well, and she does this really intense, really rigorous research, but she's also such a wonderful, lovely person and really taught me how you can be a nice person in academia as well and still do well.
A nice person in academia, what's this?
Yeah, I know.
Hold on.
Yeah, I know, there's a few of them, you've just got to find us.
Also obliged to point out Dr. Linda Kay, episode 5 of the podcast, if you want to learn more about her. Very inspirational, do concur.
Yeah, so I'd say they're probably my main two within academia at the moment.
Oh, okay, that's awesome. Now, quick fire questions.
I'm so nervous. I don't know what's going to come out my mouth.
You are going on an island retreat. You're not stranded or anything. You're just going for some time away because you've earned it, because you're a hardworking individual.
Okay.
You're allowed to take with you sort of one film or TV show box set. If it sort of comes bundled in like one thing, you can take it. That's how I'm kind of looking at it. One album, one book, and again, or you can have like a set if they come bundled together, e.g. Game of Thrones, for example. You can physically buy those together. And then one video game. What do you take?
Okay, so let's work through them. So film, I would take... how long am I on this island for?
As long as you need, as long as you want.
Okay, I'll just assume till I finish all of these things.
Sure.
So film-wise, I would take Lego Movie.
Nice.
And that includes like the first, the second one, and Lego Batman. Because why not? That's my one of my favourite films, and I know that's really cringe to say, but I think it's amazing.
It's not cringe.
It's such a good commentary on society. I love it. So yeah, I'd take that. The game I would take. Ooh, you know what? I would take Animal Crossing, and I'd restart it with the update because I'd be on the island for hours, and I'd be on an island. Playing on an island, why not?
Islandception.
Books. Islandception, indeed. Books. You know what? I would take Game of Thrones, actually, because I've been meaning to read it, but I just haven't got round to it. And so if I'm stranded on a desert island, that's a perfect opportunity to do so. So yeah.
Very good books, in my opinion. Big fan.
Have you read them?
Yes.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, I'm still mad about the TV show.
Yeah, who isn't? I mean, I've said this before with on episode 6 of the podcast with PhD researcher Daniel Walker. He talked about like how he didn't watch the show when it first came out and how he managed to avoid the spoilers, like, and is now sort of watching through it. And like, you know, it's I said this then, I'll say it now. I would be ultimately very surprised if the ending was not different in the books, should we ever actually get them. A, because I think from what I know of George R. R. Martin, he probably just gave them a very, as broad an outline as he could have and let them run away with it, you know? Like, again, like, there's also, I think, less, I mean, the stories are a bit different anyway, but with a recent example, I don't know, have you seen the Netflix series You?
Yeah, I'm halfway through the final season though, so no spoilers.
No spoilers, spoiler free. Have you read the books?
No.
Okay.
Do you recommend?
Well, honestly, no. but really, very bad, many issues. I won't get onto that rant now. But like the books are drastically different to the show, particularly into like this new third season. And I actually read the book sort of going into it to be able to compare and contrast. And like the show is just like, it's. I mean, it's not good, I'll say that much. But like you can tell that because the third book was written after the show became popularized, it has been directly influenced by the nature of the show. And it's had like an impact on it. And I think you can really tell that in the sense of the writing, and particularly with the fact that it's different. Like, I very much think the author went, well, why would I just reproduce what Netflix are going to do? They've already made changes to the story anyway. I may as well go off so people can enjoy both experiences. And you're kind of getting more out of the characters. And I just think like George R. R. Martin is the kind of troll that would just drastically change things just so everyone would get really annoyed by it.
Yeah, probably. You've made me want to read the U books, though, to be honest, because you know what? I this is a bad thing, but I just love trash TV, and sometimes I love really trashy books as well, because I feel like my research is really hard and sometimes it's really sad. So yeah, sometimes I like trash. And I think that's okay.
Do you know what? Like, I have issues with the books, and we can talk about this after the episode if you want. But
yeah,
my problem with it, just generally, is that I can't put it down. Like, it is a page turner, and like, I'm not. It's like I disagree with the content, but I binge through that thing so quick. It's the real page turners, and I'm like, if they release the fourth one, I'd buy it immediately to read it. And I don't like that about myself, but I know I would. Anyway,
I love it.
The last one is,
yeah, anyway,
what album are you going to take?
Oh God, album.
Are you a big music fan?
I am, but I don't listen to albums. I'm one of those people that listens to playlists on Spotify.
Right.
And
any episode.
My boyfriend hates that.
That's it. Close. Finished. I'm joking.
My boyfriend hates that about me. He's always saying, you know, albums are meant to be listened to in order, and you're just listening to a playlist that's on shuffle as well. Yeah, sorry. So I don't know. At the moment, I'd probably listen to an album by the Red Hot Chili Peppers, because we've just got tickets to go see them. So I'd listen to one of their albums. Okay. Not sure which one.
I mean, have you got any sort of other stuff? I mean, what kind of playlist do you listen to? I mean, I will be honest, I enjoy albums. I enjoy shuffle as well. But, like, the world allows chaos, like, just playlists. And I'm okay with that. It's part of the world.
Yeah. I quite like to listen to noughties and 90s playlists and quite cheesy stuff as well. Just because, you know, it gets you singing and all of that sort of stuff. So I do. I love the throwback. Although I have been listening to The Weeknd a lot just lately as well. This is The Weeknd playlist. So again, not an album. But yeah.
No, that's fair. I think that's fair. Okay, so I always like to wrap up with giving you the guest the opportunity to ask me a question, if you would like to. You're not obliged to.
Okay. So I know we've spoken about Pokemon a lot, but I did plan this question anyway. So if you were a Pokemon, which Pokemon would you be?
Oh gosh, this is where I cannot name a single Pokemon. I think I'll narrow it down by type. I obviously, you know, being a psychologist, I would want to be like, you know, a psychic type. And also psychic types are super OP. Absolutely.
I love psychic types.
So good. In truth, like, you know, do I reckon I'd really be a psychic type? Probably not. I would probably be like an ice type because, you know, personal albinism representations. So in terms of like an actual Pokemon, I really can't think of a name, which is really sad because I like Pokemon a lot. Because you've asked, I obviously can't think of one.
Sorry.
No, it's the whole point. It's to give the episode a bit of edge, reverse the pressure. I'm like looking around my room, being like, think. There's like an ice gym in like the third gen and the second gen as well. And I can't think of a single Pokemon name. But yeah, probably an ice type, just because I'm stone cold, you know. Maybe like a bomber snow or something like that. That's an ice and grass type. We'll go with that. I thought of a Pokemon.
Okay. So I feel like I caused you unnecessary stress there.
It's fine. That's the whole point, you know. That's the whole point. It's meant to be a laugh, even at my expense.
Oh, there you go.
Right, well...
Sorry.
No, I was just going to say all that remains for you to do is to thank you for coming on the show, unless you've got anything else to add.
No, I think we've covered just about everything we could cover, to be honest. We've gone from Pokemon, we've gone from research to yoga, we've done everything.
Well, I want to say, you know, Dr. Catherine, thank you so much for being with me. I have been psyched to be with you. A very special thank you as well for helping me close this season of the podcast.
Woo!
A tremendous achievement. So all that remains for me to do now is to say farewell to our listeners. And for those watching, I'll move over to the ending screen. I always lose it. Okay, there it is. Thank you everyone for watching. Goodbye, and we will catch you again very, very soon. Look after your mind, body, and soul. Bye-bye. Well, thank you so much for listening to another episode of Psyched to Be With You. I really hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. As ever, if you did enjoy it, please leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. It really, really helps. If you want to keep up with all things Blind Psyche, check out the episode description for a link, or you can go direct to linktr.ee/blindpsyche. Thank you so much for listening. As ever, look after your mind, body, and soul, and I will see you again very, very soon. Bye-bye.